small ones. Not.
We're gonna start right now. Can you get the good one?
Yeah.
Considered 150 books published during 2017
In the course of choosing six volumes, we decided were worthy of commendation. We looked, of course, for work of notable literary merit that had something essential and fresh to say about New York. Ours was a considerable labor of love. My fellow jurors are Bianca Calabresi, Barbara Cohen, Ellen Feldman, Ella Fauché, Janice DeMora, Carl Meyer, Stephen Raphael, Peter Sell. Will the jury please rise for a well-deserved round of applause? The hard work of others enabled us to serve our purpose. Katie Frickus of the library staff continues to be indispensable in organizing and overseeing our jury's work. We couldn't meet our responsibility without her, and she has our gratitude. Head librarian Carolyn Waters demonstrated the library's commitment to our enterprise by sitting in with us for several jury sessions. We're grateful for her interest and wise procedural comments. Three of our jurors are leaving the panel, each having served with notable dedication for several years. We'll miss the perceptive readings, witty observations, fluently expressed opinions, and fine company of Barbara Cohen, Ellen Feldman, and Pete Salvin. Thank you all so very much. We'll miss you at our table, but fortunately we'll see you around the library. And thanks, of course, to Ellen Eisner, whose generosity, love of the city, and deep feeling for this very special institution makes our enterprise possible. Now to present the first award is Juror Carl Meyer.
Hello, is the sound system working? Okay, fine. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Mike Wallace. Let me stress, not the 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace, nor the Philadelphia Eagles receiver, Mike Wallace, but Professor Mike Wallace, the distinguished professor of history at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at CUNY. And he is the co-author of our prize-winning Greater Gotham, A History of New York City from 1898 to 1919, which then went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. Let me make my own credentials clear. First, in today's online jargon, I am a verified purchaser. If you know Amazon, that means if I write a blurb, I'm not someone who just signed in, I've actually bought and read the book. From Mike's earlier book, Gotham, The History of New York City Until 1898, which earned a Pulitzer in 1989. So let me quickly say, the sequel is wholly worthy of its presence. And I hope to be around when the promised third volume makes its debut. I learned in the conversation there may have to be a fourth as well. So let me quickly also add, this is a project for which he is ideally cast. Mike values diversity, and he also prizes the right to dissent. So, where else? He was born in Queens, where more than 138 languages, by last count, are spoken, more than anywhere else in the United States. And after a few gap years, when his family went to San Francisco, he returned to our fair city and graduated from Columbia University, class of 1964. And he became the protege of Richard Hofstadter, or I like to call it Dick Hofstadter, the arguably most quoted historian of his generation, at least in the United States. 50 years ago, Mike took part in the 1968 Student Rising. Then, in 1969, he co-authored with Hofstadter a history of American violence, which is relevant today and should be an imperative book in the White House bookshelf. Then he helped found and to lead the Radical History Forum, committed to taking a fresh look at all things New York City past, as well as America in general. And then he went on to found the Gotham Center for New York City History. All this is a prelude to his newest co-production, which could justly be subtitled 50 Shades of New York History. Here, in authoritative detail, is an account of the city's political, cultural, financial, economic, criminal use, like the subject, and this whole section is there, which is written in authoritative detail and also in a literate detail. It's very readable. And I speak with personal confidence of this score. My family lived in Sunnyside, Queens, Gramercy Park, various sites in the village, and my wife and I presently live and are pleased to live in the Upper West Side. So I have seen at least 10 shades of the 50 shades. But let me see here an anecdote that I think Mike would appreciate, a family story with footnotes to his own work. Exactly 110 years ago, my mother, Dvorah Nerevsky, arrived at Ellis Island along with her mother and her younger brother. And her first experience in New York was an immigration official who said, when he looked at us, he said, "Dvorah, that won't work in New York City." He says, "You know, there's a new thing on Broadway called Wizard of Oz, Dorothy. Why don't you change your name to Dorothy?" My mother, or her surrogate mother, said, "Okay." So she became Dorothy Nerevsky. And as Dorothy Nerevsky, she went to the public schools in New York, starting out speaking only Russian and Yiddish. And then she went, after graduating from the first 8 grades, to work in a hat factory. And the woman next to her said, "Dorothy, you can't spend the rest of your life doing this." She said, "Why don't you go to night school and apply to college?" So my mother went to night school, and it was then in Harlem. And she then applied to Cornell. But the secret of her application was this, and this is something I didn't see in Mike's book. There's an organization called the Lighthouse. And the Lighthouse is for the blind. It's over on 59th Street between Madison and Lexington Avenue. And at the Lighthouse, they have a program. If you agree to be the roommate of a blind person, a blind student, i.e. to read and do all the hard work, they will pay your tuition and your room and board. My mother applied. She went to Cornell. And when she was at Cornell, other girls said, "Oh, Dorothy, what does your daddy do?" "Well, my grandfather was a house painter." So she would say, "Oh, he's a painter." This is that romantic. But because she spoke Yiddish, she then studied German. That was her major. And because she did well in German and graduated, for various reasons, she went out to the Midwest and met my father, who was of German descent in Madison, Wisconsin, working for a left-wing newspaper called the Capital Times, and married him. And I am the product. And here is the point of this whole story, is that through my family, we got to know every part of New York City. At one point, we were prosperous. We were in Gramercy Park. Another point, I was a young student, and I had to live in the poorest place in town, which was in the distant, remote corner of the West Village, in a barren place to live. Then, as we rose, we then went from one place to another. My mother went to Greenwich Village until she died just after her 93rd birthday on May 1992, so that was the end of my mother's relationship. But in all of this, a crucial point was Queens, New York. That's where my grandparents wound up. And my fault, and that's a minor criticism of Mike's book, is he doesn't say enough about the beautiful city project they had at the turn of the century, where in Queens, Jackson Heights, and elsewhere, they developed these wonderful towns. One of them was in Sunnyside, and that's where my grandparents wound up. And then, after they did well there, they went on to elsewhere in New York, and of all places, Harlem, which then was a multi-mixed country, like, in which they were in an apartment with the very first elevator, one of the very first elevators in New York City, in East Harlem. So I have all of these things together, and as I read the book, I said, my God, there it all is. There is this wonderful city, and here is this wonderful man who put it together into a memorable book, and I'm glad to yield the contract at this point, the podium at this point, to Mike Wallace. Where is Mike? Here he is.
So it would be particularly appropriate, as this library is itself a long-distance runner, still going strong after 265 years, an astounding demonstration of staying power in a city that relentlessly demolishes its past. That longevity, in turn, gives its judgments a cultural and civic authority that makes me appreciate their accolade all the more. Thanks next to my wife, Carmen Buyosa. Carmen, raise your hand. There we go. Carmen is the celebrated Mexican writer whom I first encountered on September 10th, 2001, when we both arrived to begin a year's residence at the New York Public Library Center for Scholars and Writers, the now called the Coleman Center. Romance ensued. And we eventually married on May 1st, 2005, making today our 13th anniversary. Not only provided me with the essentials that sustain long-term endeavors, love and solidarity, but her torrential creativity has been a constant inspiration. While I was slogging away on tome two, she was churning out a slew of prize-winning novels, poems, essays, plays, columns, film scripts, and hosting a TV show, Nueva York, that won her 5 Emmys. Plaudits also go to the crack team of Oxford University Press that brought Greater Gotham from hard drive to hard copy. My editor, Tim Bent, was perspicacious and patient. The production and design team, effective and creative. and Nico Fun, OUP's president, presided over a process that produced a thing of beauty. As one, now I'll add, verified purchaser on Amazon commented, quote, "The physical copy of this book I purchased is absolutely gorgeous. Lovely paper, beautifully typeset. It deserves to be savored as a physical object." Finally, I want to hail the community of historians of New York City. I use the word community advisedly. Some think that writing is a solitary occupation, and it does require periods of isolation. But writing history also requires staying in touch with a network of compatriots, keeping up with the fruits of their research, being aware of their debates and interpretation. Most who study New York's history are based in Gotham itself, but in scholarship, as in most arenas of life, the internet revolution has exploded geographical boundaries. Hunched over my keyboard, I've been able to access a worldwide matrix of resources. So my final and fathomless thanks go out to those who have produced the books, articles, blogs, and dissertations, without which this history would have been literally unthinkable. Thank you.
Say New York, and most people on this planet think of Manhattan. That's also true for many New Yorkers who live in the city's other boroughs and residents of nearby suburbs. They look to the region's lodestar for their livelihoods, culture, and cosmopolitan identity. Queens has been part of consolidated New York since 1898, but a sign on its approach to the 59th Street Bridge reads, "To the city." From Forest Hills to Flatbush, from Amaranac to Montclair, Manhattan is the focal point for all who are both within commuting distance and caught in the city's spell. Its incomparable power stirs curiosity, anxiety, ambition, and wonder. Ross Chast's Going to the City captures how those who live near but not in that feel about it. Her book is a valentine as well as a cautionary tale about a place that often evokes trepidation, confusion, and awe. The author scores one bullseye after another. She describes some of the cityscape's layout that gives fair warning to visiting pedestrians venturing south of 14th Street, where the grid unravels into spaghetti-like tangled streets. She gasped in astonishment at Midtown's variety and abundance of merchandise by taking us to a store on a nondescript street that sells 90 jabillion kinds of ribbon. She shies away from taking the fabled carriage ride through Central Park because she thinks the horses look depressed. She dubs the official Manhattan tree a leafless one whose bare branches are draped with discarded plastic shopping bags. She warns us off sitting down mindlessly in an underpopulated or vacant subway car. Any real New Yorker knows there's always at least one compelling reason to be anywhere but. And in every situation and before every distinctively rendered landmark, we see Ross Chast's inimitable people. Their deceptively intricate faces, which could only have been conjured up by her, express a treasury of emotions as they confront the city's grandeur, promise, and peril. Again and again, we laugh out loud in recognition. "This is the best place in the world," the author concludes, "an
experiment, melting pot, a fight to the death, opera, musical comedy, tragedy, none of the above, all of the above. We're retarded, we're seekers and dreamers, and also nuts. We live here anyway. Rothschild has written and drawn the truth about New York and made it hilarious. She calls going to the city, and I quote, a thank you letter and a love letter to my hometown and New Yorkers everywhere. We thank her for this New York Book Award.
Thank you so much for this. It really means a whole lot to me. Love these pipes. It's a great honor. The book is actually called Going Into Town, which is what my parents used to call it. Everybody I know called it, when I grew up in Brooklyn, and everybody I know called it, you want to go to the city? But my parents called it Going Into Town, and I don't know why. And that's why the book is called that. I've always loved New York since I was a little kid and started going in. I first went in with my parents, and then I started going in by myself when I was a young teenager. I went to the Art Students League first, and I think the Art Students League on 57th Street, and that was when I first started to get my sense of the city, meaning the subway. And I think for kids who live outside of the city, a rite of passage is learning how to drive. For me, it was learning the subway and how the different lines kind of, how you know, transferring the difference between uptown and downtown, and stuff like that. And the book was initially written, sort of sprung from a pamphlet that I had written for my daughter, who was going to school in New York. She was going to the School of Visual Arts, and my husband and I lived on the Upper West Side for a long time. We had one kid, we moved to Park Slope. We had two kids, we moved down to Connecticut. So she actually had no idea of the layout of the city. And I still remember before she went off to school, I was trying to explain to her the layout of Manhattan, and I was telling her how great it was because it's really like a grid, you know? I mean, above 14th Street, you have your avenues and you have your streets. And so if you want to go from 42nd Street to 44th Street, you walk up two blocks. And she actually said to me, "What's a block?" So that's why I made this book. I wanted to talk a little bit also here about Edie White, whose book on New York is really, if you haven't read it, it's the best book on New York ever. It's called Here is New York. And there were so many things in that book that I just thought were so spot on and so brilliant and wonderful. But one thing he said, I really related to. He said there were three types of New Yorkers. There were the natives, the people who were born here, to whom the hustle and the bustle and the congestion and the craziness, they just sort of take it for granted. It doesn't faze them. There were the commuters who lived outside of New York, who came in every day on the commuter trains and then left. And this group, the commuters gave New York its tidal energy, this flow in and flow out. And the third group were the people who came from elsewhere to find their dream, to live their dream. And I feel like I've been a part of all of those three groups. I'll just close with saying that as opposed to Frank Sinatra, who said, you know, his that horrible, horrible song about New York, which I hate so much. It gives me like a deep, like nauseous and you know, that if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. I feel 180 degrees opposite. I feel like New York is the only place that I can make it for so many reasons, not the least of which is that I really hate cars. I don't like to drive. I didn't learn to drive until I moved out of New York. and I had to learn, and I hate that. I don't really like the outdoors except for Central Park. I like to read, I like to be indoors. My politics are left of center. Mega churches really freak me out. This is really the only place that I feel like I can live. So anyway, thank you again. It's really great to meet you.
Historical novel Golden Hill as one of tonight's winners. How many people have actually read Golden Hill? Sprinkling. Okay, proselytize and evangelize after this. First, a little background about why I was so drawn to this book. A few years ago, I published a book called Daughters of the Samurai, which was a true and forgotten story about a group of little girls who were sent here by the Japanese government to spend a decade in the 1870s. I write what's called narrative history, which is a fancy way of saying history with the emphasis on story. I try to tell true stories from the archival past in such a way that all of your five senses are involved and the historical figures you're presenting have elements of excitement that make you feel like you could know them in the present or be comfortable with them in the past. I write nonfiction because I don't know how to make things up. But when I'm writing, I read as much historical fiction as I can. The best historical novelists do all the same kind of research I do, and then they make people up to live in. Their imaginations allow me to time travel, and they show me often how to bring life to the letters and documents that I'm trying to make into a story. Frances Spufford belongs in the very first rank of historical novelists. This book was published first in England, because he is British, and won the Costa Prize. It was appropriately exalted there. I'm a fourth generation New Yorker, and it took a Brit to show me what my city felt like in 1746. He actually would probably appreciate this institution as a contemporary of the period in which he was writing. He showed me how the city not just felt and sounded, but tasted. There is a sensuality and an over-the-top tactile quality to his book that is completely transporting. I was transported to a past that felt vivid and complete with this extraordinary attention to material culture, and also a neo-colonial vernacular that felt entirely authentic and was entirely accessible. If you ever struggled through Clarissa in college and wished that you were as riveted by it as you assumed people in the 18th century must have been, for it still to be published today, you'll know that feeling of wishing you could have access to the feelings that a novel was evoking. This one makes you feel like you're an authentic 18th century reader without the struggle. It's the kind of book that makes you want to know more about the period that you're allowed to access through it. It makes you reluctant to return to your own present, and it's also a galloping good story. It's not just a resurrection of a dusty past. When I was a student, I hated studying history, something that you might not expect given the fact that I write it now. But it's novelists like Frances Spufford that make historians of us all. Through that kind of storytelling, you have no choice but to be curious and investigate the past. He was not able to make the transatlantic trip to be with us, I'm afraid. But his editor from Scribner, Haley Rutledge, is here to deliver his remarks.
But I am thrilled and delighted that you should honor my novel in this way. And in particular, delighted that Golden Hill should be honored by a society which is itself the living representative of old New York. I thought when I was walking around lower Manhattan doing the research for the novel with a photocopy of an 18th century street map in my hand that nothing survived the city as it was in 1746 except the iron railings around the Bowling Green, the tombstones in Trinity Churchyard, and a few cobblestones. Now I realize that if my protagonist, Mr. Smith, had landed only a little while later, he could have borrowed books to read from this very library in his first home on Wall Street. And if he had, I promise that unlike George Washington, who seems to have kept his out on loan for 200 years or so, he would have returned them on time. Thank you very much.
If you're like me, you probably think of Art Deco more or less the way people tend to think about Zen or string theory. You kind of know what it is, but you're just as glad nobody ever asked you to say exactly what. Is Art Deco the same thing as Art Moderne? Futurism? What about Bauhaus? Well, here's Anthony Robbins to tell us it's all right, it's not our fault, because as he explains on the first page of this wonderful book, no architect or designer ever actually set out to do Art Deco. Hardly anyone had heard of Art Deco until 1966, when somebody dreamed up the name for a show in Paris that was looking back at 1920s design from a distance of 30, 40 years. Our jury goes through hundreds of books every year, and we discuss literary merit, relevance to current issues, and so on. But what we really love is to come across a book that helps us see the city in a way that feels fresh and new. What Tony Robbins tells us with enormous contagious enthusiasm is that New York's Art Deco buildings, above everything else, perfectly embody the energy, ambition, and optimism of New York in the 1920s and 30s when it was becoming the metropolis of the world. The luxury skyscrapers were the big deal, of course. The Chrysler Building, the GE Building, and their cousins. The designers embraced an aggressive, ebullient, vertical style that had room for influences ranging from Art Nouveau and Southwest Indians to King Tut and, above all, the New York City construction codes. But it turned out that many of their geometric polychrome design elements also lent themselves very nicely to the much cheaper commercial buildings and six-story apartment houses that were going up by the thousands all across New York in the 30s. The result is that once you've been alerted to them, you can find surprising and delightful specimens of Art Deco around almost any corner. And Tony Robbins is amazingly good at both the alerting and the finding. There's something else, too. His book is strikingly friendly. On page after page, he in effect takes you by the elbow and carefully shepherds you to exactly where he wants you to be. Here we are on page 123, for instance. We've just visited Bloomingdale's, and we're about to go to 57th Street and see another Art Deco masterpiece, the Fuller Building. Walk west along East 59th Street to Park Avenue. Cross Park Avenue and continue walking west to Madison Avenue. Cross to the west side of the avenue. Then turn left and walk south on Madison two blocks to East 57th Street. Cross to the north southwest corner of East 57th and Madison. Then turn around and look catty corner across the intersection at the northeast corner. And then there's a picture, in case you got lost. You need some guidance. And then, for good measure, he throws in a photograph of the sculpture and the big sign in the building, which is the reason, probably, that the name has never been changed down the decades. By the time the name was coined in 1966, Robbins says, Art Deco had fallen into almost total disrepute. Architectural historians didn't respect it, and for the rest of us, it was a depressing relic of the Great Depression. In the 70s and 80s, Art Deco was rediscovered and re-embraced to the point where some people suspected it was just another passing fad. Robbins cites a New Yorker cartoon from 1984. A typical William Hamilton couple of a certain age are in what seems to be a shop full of deco lamps and furniture and statuary. And the man is saying, you realize we're living through the second time people got tired of Art Deco? You can get that on a mug, by the way. The point, though, is that Tony Robbins has not gotten tired of Art Deco, and we think you won't either after you've spent some time in his company. But I'm going to leave the last word on this book to an old friend and a great friend of the New York Society Library, Christopher Gray, who said, if you thought you knew Art Deco, as I did before I read New York Art Deco, then buy this book and be surprised. So for giving us such a friendly guidebook and alerting us to some overlooked pleasures of the urban streetscape, I'm very happy to present the New York Society, the New York City Book Award to Tony Robbins.
Photos in the middle of the book that are just, they're knockouts, they really are. And you know, I was in graduate school in London 40 years ago, and I picked up a book about New York's cast iron architecture by the legendary, again, Marco Gale. And I showed it to one of my fellow students who was British, and she looked at it and she said, oh, I guess you know New York's becoming an historic city. Okay, I think we've always been an historic city, but I think what she really meant was we were beginning to realize that there was history here. And when I came back from graduate school, I wanted to find everything I could, and there was nothing. There were very few books. There was the AIA Guide, which had gone out of print, the first edition. There was the Columbia Historical Portrait of New York. There was the Bicentennial Project. There were some Dover reprints. And that was pretty much it. So here we are 40 years later, and the jury looked at 140 titles about New York just this year. We are an historic city, and it's a wonderful thing. So thank you so much.
Things that are interesting about the awards and why they're important awards, why we need awards for these things. And I think they really come down to three things. We want to honor people who have taken the time, the love, and the devotion to write these books. We want to make other people in the society and elsewhere aware of the books so that we can transmit the pleasures that we have had in reading it. And we want to encourage other writers to spend time to research, to learn about our fascinating city as it is. Now, if you were to look at the bulk of the books that have won awards in the past, you'll see that nonfiction has generally overwhelmed fiction in doing this. And of course, there's a reason. New York City is a real place, and it has thousands of stories to be told that are fascinating and continues to do. But I would like to give sort of a, following up on Janice's remarks, I'd like to give a spirited set of comments about the need for fiction, these things. To me, what fiction does is it creates an overhang in which you can sort of put all of your thoughts in. It gives you a way, a framework, to do this. And a really good writer manages to do that and to captivate your interest. And we're very fortunate in New York to have people who have written nonfiction books that are now classics and monumental. We're very fortunate to have Mr. Wallace here, who is now finished his second book on this. We're very fortunate to have Robert Carroll, who maybe wrote the single most interesting book about New York's politics and mechanisms. In the 19th century, we had the inimitable Phelps Stokes, who wrote The Iconography of New York, which is probably the most comprehensive putting together of the city in one place. And in Brooklyn, we have a relatively unknown person, Mr. Stiles, who wrote The Great History of Brooklyn, which is a wonderful book. But when we come to fiction, we have lots of people who've given us, they've given us a way of understanding the city. And in many cases, people who wrote this fiction fit into Rod Chast's third category of people, people who came here and became New Yorkers at a point. I mean, who would not include in the list of fictional books that give you a view of New York City? F. Scott Fitzgerald, Gatsby. I mean, Gatsby is really maybe about America, and also that it's all about New York in a period of time, and looking at it, and it brings that period of time to life. Edith Wharton gives you a picture of a somewhat earlier period of time in greater detail than anyone else has. Norman Mailer, when he wrote one of his least remembered books, Barbary Shore, wrote an incredible book about the period of time of the old left in New York City at the end of it, at the end of the war, and is a book today that says a lot. And of course, we have the inimitable Tom Wolfe. Who, what can you say? Who, if there was a book that said everything you wanted to say, and then both more and less so about the 70s and 80s, it was On Fire and Vanity. And what do these books do? They create images. They create images of the city that stick in our minds, that become part of us and the way we analyze it. And in some ways, they're more durable than the books that are not fiction, because they tell a story and the story stays with us for a long time. But to do that, they really have to have, I think, three things. They have to have characters that engage us. They have to seem to be spot on when it comes to understanding what things were like and how true they were and how true they seemed to us. And to me, when I read Manhattan Beach, I had a couple of conflicting thoughts. My first thought was, this is a wonderful book, and what's wonderful about it is that having grown up in Brooklyn, I can envision every one of the characters in it. None of them seem to me to be anything other than real people dealing with things, and dealing with them in a way that was the outer boroughs in the 1930s, the 1940s, and the dialogue is spot on in doing that. But also, there's another piece of that story, another two pieces of the story, which is that it characterized a point in time in New York's history when, particularly because of the Second World War, there were opportunities for women that did not exist in New York City before that, and women in every area rose to those occasions and dealt with that. I was thinking of, in the first chapter, when the heroine in the book puts her feet in the water in the Atlantic Ocean at Manhattan Beach, and she says, what did it feel like? It felt very cold, felt very cold, but the cold gave me an aching inside that was warm and somewhat comfortable. It was an idea that through some degree of effort on her part, was able to do more. And perhaps I, to some extent, identified with this in another way because my mother was an attorney. And she did all of these things in the 1930s and 1940s that she could never have done in her professional life before that, mainly because there were all things to do it and realization that people were there who wanted to do that. My mother, for example, weirdly enough, spent a year in Manila at the end of the Second World War, sorting out all the claims of people from the Philippines who had been killed in the Second World War, who had property and things in New York and their families. This was all done because the court system needed someone to go to do this. 2 years later, this would never have happened, never have gotten that opportunity. And I think the book, with its metaphorical, the diving under the water, is an example of the courage that people had to do these things. And I think it's very true and very realistic. Anyway, it is my pleasure to give this award. I understand that Jennifer again is not here, but a representative of her publisher is.
The result, The Leavers, has already received a number of accolades. The Penn Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction, finalist for the Nationalist Book Awards, Best Book of 2017 from National Public Radio, The Los Angeles Times, and BuzzFeed, and The Range. It's no surprise. The novel is ambitious, compassionate, insightful, and an engrossing mystery from its cagey first line. The day before Deming Guo saw his mother for the last time, she surprised him at school. Deming Guo, AKA Daniel Wilkinson, and his mother, Polly Palan Guo, offer stark, humane glimpses of current immigrant experiences. The two also enter into the annals of great mother-son relationships, recalling and challenging the family templates of the Western canon. Think Penelope and Telemachus, St. Augustine and Monica, James and Mrs. Ramsey, Little Bear and Mother Bear. But we gave the Leavers the Hornblower Prize for something more, for the alternate map of New York that it offered us resident readers, walking in winter along Fordham Road, day trips to the Upper East Side from a sweltering Rutgers Street, the precise cartographies of Grand, Pitt, Madison, Pike, Clinton, Henry, Essex, Beyond the geographical, Yes, New York is time-honored portal and gateway, as global icon of aspiration and success, but also the New York of memory, of childhood, of forfeiture, of loss. A New York carried internally that dominates the narrative, even when the characters are no longer physically there. Quote, the subway, as it shot out of the underground at 125th Street, and his mother with her arms around him saying, look! The pizzeria, the donut shop, the Chinese takeout, the shop selling rows of stiff blue jeans and dresses for $4.99. The Bronx tucked away in scraps and shards. It is for this New York, the city as point of arrival, but also of repeated departures. The city is nostos, nostalgia, or longing for home. It is for showing us this other New York and this singular family within it that we are grateful to Lisa Coe and for which we thank her with this award.
Thank you to the jury and the library, and also I want to offer my gratitude to the people whose real life stories inspired the book and continue to inspire me. I think of The Leavers very much as a love story to New York, so I'm so appreciative of it being read that way, and I feel that for my main characters, Polly and her son Deming, New York City is really kind of their promised land, the place that they feel most at home. And it was definitely that for me and my family as well. My father actually moved here from Manila in the Philippines, and he came to Utah State University in the early 60s because they gave him a college scholarship. You can imagine that was really shocking, culture shock, and also a really alienating place to be. And the minute he graduated, like on his graduation day, he got in a car and drove straight to New York and never went back. and my mom, too, came from Manila. She spent a few days in Northern California before she also hightailed it to New York City and never looked back. They met in Queens, where I was born a few years later. Sadly, I grew up in New Jersey. New Jersey is like my Utah. But I always knew, like, from a young age that, you know, I felt like I was in exile from New York City, the place where I could most be myself, and that as soon as I was old enough, I would move back, which I did. So for my two characters in The Leavers, you know, Deming, my main character, he's born in New York, and he and his mother live in the Bronx until the day that she goes to work and she never comes home. And he eventually is adopted by a white couple that kind of move him to what is really like another planet. They move him to upstate New York in a small town. And so Deming's journey really to find his mom and to find himself and to kind of find a sense of home is really about him finding his way back to New York as well. So I think a lot about, you know, kind of the way that the city is a place that's really captured the imagination of so many artists and writers. But I also think about all the stories that aren't being told and that should be told and heard. So thank you so much for supporting this one.
So I just want to thank everybody for coming, and we're not finished just yet because I'm going to ask Warren to come up and lead us in a toast, which if you need some more bubbly, we're gonna get you some of that. But I want to encourage you to stay and have some more wine and food and buy some books, have them signed by our winners, and enjoy yourself. Thanks again for coming. Warren, come on up.
I'd like to raise a glass first to the library, to the jury, to the winners, to the members of this library, sustained it for more than 200